We have a class to make up. Unlike the previous time where I smooshed two lectures together into one period, I'm not going to do that this time. We will just slip the schedule, and I'm going to slip it into the next section, which I believe is scheduling, because scheduling is not really that interesting. So I can throw away one of those courses and devote the full complement of four lectures to processes, because processes are important. I shouldn't say scheduling is not important. I am not interested in scheduling. I think at some point I will say something, in fact, I may have already said this, that in fact one of the ways to look at operating systems is as essentially it's a giant scheduler. So from that point of view, of course, scheduling becomes important, but we're not going to spend too much time on it. I will steal from there. We begin on processes. To do that, let's figure out what it is operating systems are doing when they deal with processes. And the answer to that question is to go back to the previous lecture and take a look at program execution. So what were the aspects of system architecture that we had looked at that were directly related to process execution, as opposed to like indirectly related in the sense that, well, maybe they use it? What are the pieces? Well, actually, that's not a good way to say it either, but I'll say it this way. What are the pieces that have to be there to do program execution? And what we want are the essential components. CPU, storage. These are actually the only, we need one more very important thing. But these are the two that we're going to look at. There is one more very essential thing we need to have, and then there's one other thing you could say that's true, but we're not going to pay attention to. Yes?
RAM?
That would be storage. We'll put that in with storage. RAM, ROM, disk, those, you know, we're not going to distinguish in this section. Is that true? Let me just say this. We're not going to distinguish between those kinds. That's probably not true. Program and execution. Very important part, third part, that we actually need. Because if we have this, what do we have? Hardware. What does hardware do? Nothing. Gets warm. So what's the third thing we need? Program. And the fourth thing that I mentioned that we're not really going to pay attention to but should be there just for completeness sake, that's something that we are, that's correct, but we're not going to be concerned about that. Bus, exactly. The connection between CPU and RAM, and can you give a name to the... We gave a name to the bus. Do you remember what that was? It was an unofficial name. Von Neumann bottleneck. And that's essentially the connection between storage and CPU. So to draw the picture. So that's where we left it. Now we get to fill in the details, because the operating system is going to be responsible for handling those details, as well as lots of other details that we'll get into in further lectures. Let's take a look at storage first. What is storage? What was the abstraction of storage I had talked about? Or you may have learned elsewhere. I mean, it's a fairly common abstraction. What does storage look like when you say storage? Yes. Just one?
Array.
An array. Right. An array of? Bytes, let's say. Units. We'll call them units without. So we have this big array of bytes or units, and it has some address structure, which we're not going to be concerned about here. That comes later in the semester. But it's sort of array-like in nature, as you might expect. All right, so here's our storage, which is essentially equivalent to that. Where's the program? Somewhere in store at the beginning of. At the beginning, sorry. So, but we'll just say somewhere. It could be at the beginning, but we'll just say it's at somewhere. For now, it occupies a contiguous sequence of units, bytes or words or whatever. Do we need anything else? You don't have to answer this right away, but if you can, that would be useful. So we have this. What else do we need? Yes, we'll get to that in a second, but just with respect to storage. And the reason I mention this is because the structure, the answer is yes, by the way, the structure that we essentially come up with here is a structure that the operating system is going to have to provide. Because, again, This is an array of units. That's it. So anything else that you see there is going to have to be created. And that's the job of, among the jobs of the operating system. So let's, you may have seen these pictures elsewhere in your programming classes, or perhaps even in your architecture class. What else does a program need to execute?
What does a program do?
In general? Yes, that's true. To what end? For what purpose? Accomplish a task, and how would you characterize that task? There's lots of different ways, but just think of back. Okay, output. But what is it outputting?
Data.
Data, exactly. So in order for a program to execute, it needs to have data. All right, it munges data. Programs munge data. That's a technical term. Which means that we're going to need at least one section of storage for data. And it turns out we're going to need several. So now we have a slightly more complicated structure. We have a program, and then we have data. We're going to have to actually refine this. I don't know if we need to do it in this particular lecture, but this is going to be refined eventually. Does anybody know how that refinement is going to go, just right offhand? Maybe, may or may not. Static versus dynamic data is another difference. And the thing that we're interested in, of course, is the dynamic data, because, again, the operating system is going to be responsible for providing that. And we will talk a little bit about that in later lectures in this section, and we'll talk a lot more about it when we talk about storage management. All right, so here's what we have in storage. This is what storage is dealing with. And for the moment, we'll leave it at that. Now let's take a look at the CPU. What's in there? What do we have in a CPU?
Yes.
We have registers, which is actually what we're interested in. So you jump right to the chase. And we'll come back to those. What else? The ALU, okay. And
control unit.
There's other interesting things in here that we'll, some of them we'll talk about, some of them we'll just completely ignore. Caches, we will not be talking about in, well, we'll be sort of mentioning them incidentally, but we're not going to be dealing with them very much directly. And let's see, what else are there? There's caches, there's things like the translation look-aside buffer, there are things like the memory management unit. These are all things that we're going to be talking about in later sections. But with these three pieces, that's pretty much all we need to be concerned about. And in fact, we can just ignore the ALU and the control unit. They're there, they're important, but with respect, well, actually, then let me just go on. With respect to the operating system, they're not really, can't really do anything with those because they're hardware. The registers, on the other hand, are something that, as you're finding out, as you do your first programming assignment, you're going to have to be touching all the time. And by you, of course, I mean your operating system. So let's take a look at the registers. What can we say about the registers? Can we further divide the registers into subcategories? So we've got the category of register, of CPU resident register, and can we further subdivide those? Is there some useful way to break those up further? And the answer, again, is yes. So the question then becomes how. We have registers, right? But is there any other structure in a register, in a what they call in the hardware world a bank of registers or a file of registers? I like file myself. Is there any other structure there? That's the reason we're interested. So the reason I'm doing this is because registers represent state. That's why we're interested in it, and by we, of course, I mean operating systems. So that's why we're interested in it. But let's break it up even further, because different kinds of states, so that's another way to attack the problem. What are the different kinds of, this is a little bit abstract, what are the different kinds of states that a register can have? What is a register control?
Well, I might be mixing up my words
there. I think you are. There we go. That's what I was looking for. Okay. Is that what you were talking about?
I was mixing up the
words. Okay. So essentially what we can do is we can divide. What I was afraid somebody was going to say was, oh, there's integer and floating point. And that's correct, but those are actually both categories of data. So what we can do is we can take our registers and chop them. And one of those, the larger of the two, is data. And the other are control. Now, to a certain extent, we don't care. because, and again, by we, I mean operating systems. The operating system doesn't care because they more or less have to be handled the same. On the other hand, the control registers are properly the purview of operating systems. Operating systems have the right to put their tiny little fingers all over the control registers. On the other hand, the data registers are pretty much fingers off. They should be faithfully restored or manipulated. And that's not quite true. There are certain of the data registers that do become the purview of the operating system, but for the most part, we can just assume for the moment anyway that they are just treated as a big block that is opaque to the operating system. But that's not true for the control registers, which is why it's important to single these out. And what kind of control registers might we be interested in? Or that what kind of control registers exist? Well, what do control registers do? Why are they different from data registers? So what are some control registers? Program counter, the location of the next instruction in primary store to execute. There are various limit registers that we will talk about, which are essentially used to figure out where these points are, to set boundaries. And we'll discuss why we're going to do that in a couple of minutes. Anything else? Status registers. These are things that, for example, indicate whether or not the system is running in virtual store versus physical store, which is something we'll talk about when we talk about the storage management part of the operating system. Whether or not the system is operating in user mode or kernel mode or unprotected mode and protected mode. There are some bits in there for that. Things like the condition bits, condition code bits, whether or not the most recent operation, arithmetic operation, resulted in something that was positive or negative or zero, things like that. These registers, and this is the reason that we're interested in them in terms of dealing with operating systems, are the things that control the execution of the overall system. Of course, the program itself controls the specific execution. But the status registers, in part, also serve to control the overall execution. All right, so I believe this is all we need to talk about. And, of course, there's the link between them, which we don't really care that much about. But there it is. So this is pretty much what we had talked about, although perhaps not to this level of detail in the previous lecture. And this is pretty much all we need to talk about for processes that we're going to be talking about in this section. And this is pretty much with, you do have limit. So this is pretty much what the programming assignment looks like, too. So this is a static picture of what we have. Now, what's the dynamic picture look like? What does a executing program look like in a system like this? The general outline. I don't have to go into great detail. Or, if you want, you can start describing it in great detail, and then we can back off. Whichever you find easiest. Well, what do we want to do? What's the point? What's the objective here? Run the program. So, in order to do that, what has to happen? That's way generic, but sure. Okay, so what are the inputs and what are the outputs? What are the inputs and what are the outputs? What kind of data? All right, but how does that go? That's what we're trying to figure out. What is that process? See, because this is what we have to do. We have to make this go. So what does that entail? Exactly. So there's an instruction that arrives from primary store into the CPU, and in fact, it lands in the control unit for decode. Right? Remember the fetch, decode, execute cycle. And we don't need to go down to the microcode level where we actually say fetch, decode. We're just interested in the behaviors. Now you can go. Going to read some data. So you're going to, potentially anyway, depends on the instruction, but let's just put it in there. When wouldn't you fetch data? Just right offhand, any assembler programmers here? When wouldn't you fetch data? Well, first of all, for an instruction that doesn't need it, but let's assume that the instruction needs data. When you have a register-to-register instruction, if the data are already in the registers, nothing to fetch. But let's assume that we do fetch. And what's next? We have the data. We have the instruction. Excellent. Execute what? Whatever the instruction's telling you to do. Right. So we do the operation. And That's true. Give me something less generic and more in the context of what we are discussing here. So you're right. It's output results. But what results? And what does output mean? Write the data back to wherever. Well, let me not say write. Let me say store. And again, if you have an instruction that is, for example, manipulating the control registers, well, that's, you're writing data there too. So, yeah, you're probably always going to store data. But it may not actually go back out to primary store. You may, in fact, put it in a data register. If you're doing a register-to-register operation, or it just may be some signal that goes out over a bus. For example, if you raise the interrupt disable flag via an instruction. Anything else? Well, yeah, there's lots of other things, but as far as we're concerned, well, there is actually one other thing. But as far as we're concerned, this is it. What's the last thing? Go back to the top and start it all over again. And, of course, there's stuff up here that we haven't talked about. What is an obvious example? We haven't adjusted the PC, right? Because what's going to happen is if you don't change the PC, then you're going to get the same instruction you got last time. So there's all kinds of other things going on, but we don't need to worry about those because they are mostly taken care of by the execution of the CPU and, in particular, the control unit. Okay, so this is the behavior that a particular executing program entails. And this is the behavior that should be supported by the operating system. And that seems kind of obvious, right? But it turns out that, in particular in later lectures, we are going to have far more complex behaviors, but they all boil down to this. So regardless of what we do in later lectures, it's all going to have to result in something that behaves more or less like this. Any questions about any of that? That's pretty, again, it's mostly review. My question is, what is the result of all of this? What have we just ended up with? And this is like an obvious question. So the obvious answer will do. What is the consequence of all of this hardware and behavioral specification? That is way in advance of what I'm looking for. Just with respect to, I mean, you're right, but just with respect to this picture that we've been drawing up here, I don't want to say it. But what is that? What are those two things you just described? Your answer is way too unobvious. Exactly. It's a program in execution, an operating system is a program in execution, so in that sense you were right. But this is essentially just a program in execution. Oops. And this is a behavior and abstraction, as we will figure out in a couple of minutes, that the operating system has to provide. And in some sense, you could argue it is the fundamental abstraction. If you don't provide this, then there's really not much point in doing anything else. So this is the fundamental abstraction. And here's an example of where I don't know how to spell. Is it D-I or D-A? D-A, thank you. So this is the fundamental abstraction. Okay? And this is what we are going to work to provide in this section. That's the point of this section. Questions about that? And just for the hell of it, what is the name of that abstraction? The process. But we'll have to work up to that point. Now, there are two directions that we can go in at this point. Think about how we might provide this abstraction. Because it is at this point that we start coming up with the facilities that we need for our operating system. So we need to provide this abstraction in the operating system, and now the question becomes, let me identify it. There's no reason to be so mysterious. So what we want to do is now develop the process abstraction. But, you know, I worry that I'm probably under-motivated. Why would you want to abstract this? Given this is the level that we're at now, this is what our system looks like, why would you want to abstract anything? What would be the point in doing that? What would you hope to achieve by abstracting from this? Oh, actually, that's not a bad question. What would you hope to achieve by doing that? What would be the point? Because if there is no point, then we're done. We can go home and watch TV, the Rangers in particular. But, unfortunately, we can't. Because there is a point. And what is it? Well, what's the general point for abstractions? Why do we find them interesting? I know there's at least one software engineer in here. Okay, so we want to provide, let me not say conformity, because that sounds so cruel. Let me say uniformity. Although, to get more at what you're pointing at by saying conformity, we could also say structure. I'll say uniformity of structure. Anything else? And this is actually pretty important. In fact, this is probably all we need. This is the way people usually design operating systems. They figure out, well, how do we make this program run? And let's provide that, and that's it. We're done. And, in fact, you can do that to a certain extent in your assignment, too. But you do have to think ahead, right? Because there are things that are going to be coming that would require, if you had thought about them earlier, would make things easier for you later, which is typically the case. Right? So there's uniformity of structure. Anything else? Well, let's leave it at that for now. Given that we're interested in defining uniformity of structure, we need to define a structure first. Okay, so what would that structure look like? And again, you can do whatever you want, right, because we have essentially tabula rasa here. Well, given that this is our general picture, and we're going to make it more complicated later on in the lecture, what kinds of things do we want to indicate by our structure? What would this structure involve if we were going to do it? And you are going to do it, so. We're not there yet. That was the thing I was debating about earlier, whether I should introduce that now or introduce it later. And I think I can introduce it. Well, maybe I should have introduced it now, but. So let's put that off to the side for the moment. Again, looking at this picture, this is the context of the discussion here, this picture on this part of the board. What are the aspects of the structure that we would like this picture? Wait a minute, I didn't say that right. What aspects of this picture do we want to reflect in the structure, in this notion of a executing program? Between and?
And hardware.
Ah, that's what I thought you were saying. Yeah, but we only have one process. That's the other thing we're going to be introducing in a couple of minutes. Right now, we only have one program in execution. Okay? And we'll come back to that. See, that's what I was thinking. I was like, well, I could either try and force the motivation for more than one program, or we could just work with this, because this is easier. So I decided to work with this, and then we'll come back to what you're saying. But you're right. I mean, that's a very important motivation. Again, the question is, just be mercenary about it then. You're developing a class. What fields do you want in that class to represent this particular idea? Well, that's the job of the CPU. But what was the first? Units? What's that? Well, no, that's... I guess I'm not understanding that, because it's just like a sequence of execution, right? A linear sequence until you hit a jump, and then you go someplace else. And so that's more or less taken care of by the instruction set in cooperation with the control unit. And that's defined by the instruction set architecture, which, for the most part, assuming we're not dealing with microprogramming, the operating system can't really fiddle with. Except on the gross scale of saying that, oh no, you execute in user mode, and so you can't do the subset of instructions. Again, what are the other parts? What are the things that you need to know for a program in execution? Be more specific. It means what? Where the program is located and located where. Exactly. So one of the things we need is the region, the storage region. All right. We need to know the range of legal addresses for that program. And we also need to know something else. So we have this part of our picture. What other parts of the picture do we need? Is it enough when you're executing a program just to have a region of storage? Is that all you need? Or perhaps there may be something else. The program. Exactly. What are you executing? Now, this is not the program itself, but some representation, like, for example, where you can find the program or various other pieces of information. But for now, this is good enough for us. The location of the program on disk, you know, however you want to represent the program. But you need to have some indication of what's being executed. And let's see, does anybody else want to add anything? I think at this point we can stop, because we're going to put more things in to this particular structure. but we need to get there first to motivate it. Well, what does this give us now? So now we have this, but that's just a picture of that's just a representation of this picture. So what? Why is that important? What kind of leverage does this having this particular representation give us? Well, again, it's related to the idea of abstractions. Why do you do abstractions? Actually, you're going in the wrong direction. You're giving me too much detail. What's the point of abstractions? The point of abstractions is to suppress detail. Right, so the reason that you define abstractions is because you want to actually not pay attention to the fact that you're executing step by step. You would like to deal with, in this case, a program in execution at some higher level. Okay? And that's the essence of the process. It is a way to essentially abstract all this mess as a relatively simple concept for manipulation, which we'll talk about later on tonight and on into the subsequent lectures. So again, just to restate what I was saying, we now have abstractions of running processes, running programs. But you should probably put running in quotes, because it turns out that a lot of the times a program will not be running, but we'll get to that eventually. Okay, any questions about that? That is, in essence, why we're interested in this idea of a process, and we have started on our representation. Given that we have this now, this nice little package that we can talk about, we can begin to do two things, and these are the two things I was talking about earlier. And one of them is we can have more than one program running at a time. Now, why would you want to do that? Is that a useful thing to do? And that question is not quite as stupid as it sounds. Because as you will find out, answering the question positively, yes, we want to have more than one thing running at the same time, increases complexity enormously. So you are, in fact, paying an extremely heavy price when you decide you want to have more than one thing run at the same time. And we have to talk about what it means to say at the same time, too, which is actually the other thing I was thinking about here, because, of course, what's missing from this picture, at least relative to modern CPUs, is the idea of multiple cores, but we're not going to talk about those. That, again, makes things more complicated. So the question is, do we actually want to have things running, more than one thing running at the same time? More efficient. Could you give me what you mean by efficient and tell me then how having more than one process running at the same time achieves that efficiency? I don't want to go and say that you're correct. You certainly could be correct, but we'd have to look a little bit closer, and I think it might be useful to do that. So, what do you mean by efficiency? All right, that's a good argument for having more than one program.
Yeah.
Right? It's not clear to me that has anything to do with efficiency, but let's not worry about that. Let's just say that. All right, so how would you characterize that? So you're right about what you said about the random number generator. Give me a characterization that covers more than just random number generators. Okay, I'm not clear on why I would want to do that. I mean, what do you mean by save runtime? I'm sorry, I'm not picking it up, so I have no doubt that you're saying something, but I'm not understanding what you're saying. Maybe we can clarify it as we go along. But can you give me, can you give me a sort of general argument about, give me a general characterization of what you're saying? Yes, that's true, but that's sort of away from what we're talking, because the question is program. Not hardware.
Okay.
Right, so the question I'm asking is, more than one program running, do you want to do this? Yes, the answer is yes. Well, actually, it's not, because people have written operating systems in which the answer, well, it's a little tricky, but let me just be incorrect and say the answer is no. People said no, the complexity of running more than one program at the same time just is not worth it, and we should only run one program at the same time. Oh, that's a good thing. Let's do it this way then. Let's suppose the answer is no. You can only run one program at a time. What does that system look like? How are we wasting time? It's doing something, right? Who cares? CPU time is cheap. It's free. No, that's not quite true, but it's free. And you get heat from it too, so it keeps you warm. What happens if you can only run one program at a time? But that's a good point. Is that really the case, that a word processor only runs one program at a time? Because what do you do in addition to processing words? Yeah, and, well, as you are writing, what happens? You want to do things like spell check, right? That's a separate program. That's not word processing. That's something completely different, right? So, and you could argue that, well, no one would want to write their paper and have it spell checked at the same time. They want to write their paper, save it, and then run the spell checker, right? But, and people have done this, you know, you probably would not produce a reasonable word processor then. And, you know, they want to do grammar checking. They also want to do WYSIWYG editing, right? So it's not, I want to sit, look at Courier fonts. I want to look at high-resolution bitmap displays of the printed output. Right? So, again, I'm not just typing words. I am formatting output. And, again, that's a different program. Right, so the idea that you can get away with having just one program in execution, while it's seductive in the sense that it gives you a real simple system, it's also impractical in the sense that the system is extremely limited. Now, we are talking within a particular context here. Of course, if you are an embedded systems programmer, you're saying, well, yeah, you always want a system that does one thing at a time. Right? Because you don't have a whole lot of store to play with, and you don't have to do a lot. Now, that's actually not quite true, because you're still doing several things at the same time. So by looking at what you get when you only have one program in execution, that gives you an idea as to whether or not you really want this kind of system. And one of the reasons that you do is because it's almost always the case that you're doing more than one thing at once. And you need to be able to represent that to the users of your system. And this is what's known as concurrent execution, concurrency. But let me just not say that, because that's a technical term we'll come up with in the third section, I believe. So the answer is yes, because you do more than one thing at a time, right? Real life is more than one thing at a time. And if you want to be able to reflect that in your system has to provide for that. There are other arguments that you can make, and we'll talk about some of them as we go along. Another approach to take is that it is a very nice design technique, right? This is more for the software engineers, but it's also for everybody, is that breaking up a single program into multiple programs, as we did with the word editor. You could just say, no, I could cram everything into a word editor. I could have a word editor, I could have and have it be a spell checker, and have it be a formatter, and then have it generate high resolution graphics output, right? So I have this big mother program that does everything. Okay. And that's just terrible design. You would never finish it, and as you were working to finish it futilely, it would be incorrect. Right? So breaking up a big program into individual programs and having those programs cooperate, somebody mentioned cooperation, I don't know who it was, is an excellent way to do design. And that applies to the operating system too, right? Because the operating system has to do more than one thing at a time. In fact, it's doing a lot of things at a time. So this structure that we're talking about with respect to these programs also applies to the operating system. So in that sense, it becomes sort of recursive when we talk about the things that an operating system wants to do to provide to the users of the system. Those are things that the operating system itself is also going to use. And that's one of the things I really like about operating systems, is that they are just repeatedly recursive. And we'll see this over and over again. We'll be talking about techniques that the operating system provides that the operating system itself exploits. I just think that's really interesting. It's kind of like an Ouroboros, you know, the snake that's eating its own tail. It's like that. Exactly like that. Write that down. Okay, do we want to beat on this? Oh, no, I don't think we do. Well, we could beat on this, but I think we need to move on. All right, so there is an argument for having more than one program run at the same time, so we'll take that as given, and that's one of the things we need to provide. There's another important, and that is, again, remember, we're asking ourselves, why is this useful to think about? There is another aspect of providing this representation for a running program, and it's related to the idea of what a running program needs. So we've identified some aspects to an actual running program. It needs some place and storage, and some of that is for the code, and other of it is for the data. What else does a program need to execute? And another way to ask that question is, what other resources does an executing program need? And again, the answer here is there are lots of them, and we'll just look at some of them now. And as we go along through other lectures, we will throw more and more of these things into this particular list. But for now, just think of some. What are some other things that what does a program do, generically? Okay, takes data from where? How did you characterize takes data? Input. It needs input. All right, so it needs some, and let's assume that it needs some devices to do that. So it needs input devices. What else? What else does a program do in general, generically?
Mutators.
Sorry?
Mutators.
Mutators, that's a nice word. What does that mean? Well, that's what the instructions do, right?
Mutators.
Right. So, and we already have instructions up here.
Okay.
Right, so that's a resource that we've taken care of. But yeah, that's right. But then what happens after the data's been mutated?
Store.
Oh, store. Exactly. So what do I need to store? Yeah, which are output devices. Right, so it may have some input devices allocated to it. In fact, it probably does, depending. Let's go back to the word processor, right? It has a keyboard, and that's input, maybe mouse, and it has a terminal of some kind, that's output. And what else? Are there some other kinds of resources that you might want to associate with a program? You're correct. We'd have to go into more detail about that, because it's not so much the compiler itself as the thing that the compilers produce, but let's not do that. You're right, and it's actually interesting, and unfortunately we're not going to be able to talk about that in this class. Well, only just on the side. But yeah, you're right. I mean, things like symbol tables. In some circumstances, but let's just keep it general. You know, symbol tables, debug tables, and also sometimes memory maps, stuff like that. So yes, that would be important, but I'm not going to include that. Anything else? Raise the level. All right, so we have input devices, output devices. What else does a word processor, what other kinds of resources does a word processor have associated with it? It's reading data from someplace, right? Or presumably you're not creating a document, you're using a document, but you're certainly going to output, so you also need a file to store the document. All right, so these are, and of course there's plenty of other ones, there's lots of other ones. So these are other resources that the running program might need. All right, now these are specific to a particular program, and there are also resources that are generic to all programs, but we won't get into those yet because we need more detail about them. Well, so what? Why are we talking about this? It's interesting, undoubtedly, but so what? What do we do with this information? Exactly, but set it up how? That's the question I'm asking. And it's within the context of this discussion. So how would you set it up? What does that mean to set it up? You're right, but that's too advanced, right? We haven't talked about any of that stuff here. But what have we talked about? This idea of the structure of a process, right? We have, at this point, identified the structure of a process as a region of storage and then some things like programs, okay? But now we've also identified some other aspects of a process, of a program in execution, and they represent the resources that are needed by that program, that process to execute. So the reason that these are important is that these become part of the structure of the process. In other words, these become part of the structure, the abstraction that we're using to represent a running program. Right. And this takes us to this what I'm going to call the definition of a process. And this is the way I think about it. The book has a different point of view, and that's fine, but I find it useful to think about a process is a bag of resources that a program needs to run. Right. And that's what I think of as a process, and that's a useful thing to think about. And the bag here is a bag in the technical sense, in the mathematical sense, if you're familiar with it. But if you're not, then you can just think of it as, you know, something you haul over your shoulder, not unlike Santa Claus. Except, So if you look at a process, which is the abstraction implemented by the operating system of a program in execution, you will see almost everything that process needs to run on that system. All right, so that's our first definition of a process. It allows a program to be turned into something that can execute by allocating resources, which goes back to your point, to the system. Except for one important resource, which somebody mentioned here, and that's the CPU, which is represented as, since somebody mentioned threads, and I said we're not going to talk about that until the next set of lectures, I'll just tell you that the abstraction that we're going to use to actually represent the CPU, and in more modern times, the cores in the CPU are the threads. So from that point of view, and sometimes you'll hear this said, then that makes a process, and this is sort of counterintuitive, but again, I think it's a useful way to think about it. This makes a process be a passive object. A process itself cannot execute because it does not have that central abstraction, that CPU. All right, now, this is counterintuitive for those of you that have thought about the notion of a process as something that's active, right, something that is executing in a system. But the distinction between a passive bag of resources and the actual CPU, I think, is an important one, and it's pretty much untenable to think about processes as being entirely active in and of themselves. The reason for that is because you have limited execution facilities. You can do this, I should say. You can do this. You can actually create processes that are active in the sense that they also represent the CPU. What's the difficulty with that? I don't know. That's actually kind of a... I don't want to say it's a hard question, but does anybody know right offhand? It's probably not a question we want to spend a tremendous amount of time on. What would be the problem with binding the notion of actual CPU execution into a process? Actually, this is an interesting point, so let's pursue it. What's the difficulty there? No, it would run better, right? That's the point. That's why I'm saying that CPUs are passive, because they... I'm sorry, not CPUs. Processes are passive because they don't have the CPU. And you're right, but now what's the consequence of that? I mean, one nice thing, as you just pointed out, is we now get to say that processes are active. Great. But why is that a problem? I mean, that's pretty much what you want, right? So why is that a problem? Okay, but why is that a problem? Eventually you'll do an exit instruction or whatever. So that's, in fact, if you're running an operating system, that's right. You'll never stop. So that's exactly what you want. Yes, it does. But why? That's the question. Yeah, but what's the limit? That's right. I mean, you're both right. But what is the limit? It's not the fact that you can only execute one instruction every third of a nanosecond. Although that is a limitation. That's not a limitation that the operating system. Sorry.
Limited resources.
Right. But what is the resource that's limited? No, what are we talking about? We're talking about the CPU. The problem with assigning the CPU to the process is you are limited by the total number of CPUs, right? Because you can only have as many CPUs, or let me now say cores, as there are in the hardware, right? So if you have a quad-core system, that means you can have four executing processes. That's it, because... if you want a fifth, well, where's the CPU coming from? Yes, that's right. So you have to you're limited by the number of CPUs or cores that you have available. And the limit is in the number of processes. So if you bind the idea of execution to the process representation, the abstraction, you are limiting yourself, you are limiting the system to the number of execution engines, let me say, that you have in the system. And that's something that you would like to avoid, because you almost certainly don't have enough, for most stock hardware, you certainly don't have enough execution engine to execute all the processes that you want. So by separating the execution part from the process part, you now have the ability to multiplex or virtualize, both of those are the same, the CPU. So by allowing for passive processes, we get to implement a virtual CPU. This will be the topic of the last two lectures in this section, and that's another way to think about threads. Threads are nothing more than virtual CPUs, or to be modern, which I should be, I suppose, virtual cores. And the way you get virtual cores is by multiplexing them. So the advantage to thinking about passive processes is you decouple the execution engine from everything else, which then allows you to multiply the number of processes that you can execute. And that's why scheduling becomes important, but we'll come into that later. Questions about this? So this is our motivation for coming up with processes. Let's see. I think at this point we can leave this. And now that we have erected, partially erected anyway, our platform that contains processes, we can now sort of forget about this stuff and deal with abstractions, which is another reason why you like abstractions, because that allows you to push stuff that you're not interested in down out of sight. Are there any questions?